Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with a leak of documents from the Obama administration's secret free trade negotiations for the Trans-Pacific Partnership Trade Pact, obtained by Lori Wallach, the founder and director of Public Citizens Global Trade Watch. She joins us to discuss the explosive contents of this secret trade agreement under negotiation that are diametrically opposed to Obama's and the Democrats' 2008 campaign promises. Then we'll go to Prague in the Czech Republic and speak with economist James Galbraith about the growing gloom in the Eurozone, with Greece in default and Spain, after receiving a cash infusion, finding its borrowing costs have increased, and now Italy facing a hostile bond market and questions from its northern neighbors, all indicating that the Band-Aid approach to this ongoing two-year crisis is not working. Then finally, we'll look into an infographic report from the Center for American Progress indicating that the Latino vote is a sleeping giant that, if awakened, will determine the outcome of the 2012 elections. The head of the team that produced this report, Angela Kelly, the Vice President for Immigration Policy and Advocacy at the Center for American Progress, joins us. Joining us now is Lori Wallach, who's the founder and director of Global Trade Watch, a division of the nonprofit watchdog group Public Citizen. Lori Wallach is an expert on the operations and outcomes of trade policies such as NAFTA, WTO, and CAFTA. She works closely with Congress, scholars, and activists in the U.S. and developing countries to foster the growing debate about implications of different models of globalization on jobs, offshoring, wages, the environment, public health and food safety, equality and social justice, and democratically accountable governance. Today, Public Citizen posted leaked documents from the Obama administration's free trade negotiations for the Trans-Pacific Partnership Trade Pact. Welcome to Background Briefing, Lori Wallach.
Thank you very much.
And these documents give us a window into the negotiations that have been going on for this Trans-Pacific Trade Pact that both the Obama administration and Mitt Romney in this election year are both in favor of. But it seems to be, from what I've learned from the leak that you've provided the public with, Lori Wallach, that this what's revealed runs contrary to the campaign promises issued by Obama and the Democratic Party during the 2008 campaign. Specifically, I just quote, "We will not negotiate bilateral trade agreements that stop the government from protecting the environment, food safety, or health of its citizens, give greater rights to foreign investors than to U.S. investors, require the privatization of our vital public services, or prevent developing country governments from adopting humanitarian licensing policies to improve access to life-saving medications." Tell me about how much what you've revealed is not in line with that promise.
Well, these Trans-Pacific Partnership negotiations have been going on for almost 3 years in conditions of extreme secrecy. And what we've seen with this text that's leaked, and several that leaked at the end of last year, is really an indication of why they're being so sneaky. Because if the public had any idea of what they were doing, we wouldn't put up with it, to say nothing of Congress. Basically, this agreement is exactly the opposite of that pledge. For instance, the document that has leaked today is the investment chapter. It explicitly would require signatory governments, including the U.S., to give preferential treatment to foreign investors, including compensation from our tax dollars, for the costs of having to comply with the normal land use, environmental, health, other regulations that every company here has to meet. It's the mindset, actually, of the U.S. negotiators helping the big U.S. companies with their offshore operations without really thinking about the boomerang effect of foreign companies attacking our laws, as well as the outrageousness of our companies being allowed to attack other countries' laws. With respect to medicines, that's the leak that happened several months ago. That chapter on intellectual property actually rolls back initial reforms in that regard that President Bush made. So when you look at this agreement, there have been 600 official U.S. corporate advisors. Congress, the press, and the public have been locked out. And the result is an extremely lopsided corporate government agreement that really has only a little bit to do about trade. That's the brand. But it would implement a whole set of different policies, jacking up medicine prices, undermining domestic financial regulation, environmental regulation. That's just totally unacceptable and, by the way, contradicts Obama's current domestic agenda.
So these 600 corporate advisors, they have access, they've had access all along to these documents that you've just gotten a window into.
The corporate advisors are security cleared, and the U.S. has increasingly classified these trade documents. Keep in mind, these are not the nuclear codes. These are rules about limiting government regulation that some corporations want. The cleared advisors, 600 corporations, 15 environmental labor representatives, have access to all the U.S. proposals, to the process, and to some of the combined texts. What leaked today is a composite text that's the actual 90% completed text for this agreement. So it shows what the U.S. has agreed to, but all the other countries as well, and it's extremely troubling. But yes, while the public who's going to live with the results, and I might add Congress, who's supposed to be in charge of making these policies, has been locked out, the corporate advisors have been in. The secrecy is so bad that the senator, Ron Wyden, a free trader from Oregon, who is the chairman of the Senate Trade Committee that has specific jurisdiction over TPP, has been denied access to these texts. Even the text of what the U.S. submitted as our positions in the negotiations, as has his staff. And he was so outraged at the very end of May, he submitted legislation demanding access, which has not yet moved. He's the chairman in charge of the committee that's supposed to be overseeing this.
Again, I'm speaking with Laurie Wallach, who's the founder and director of the Global Trade Watch, a division of the nonprofit watchdog group Public Citizen. And she received these leaked documents, which have been posted today by Public Citizen, of the Obama administration's free trade negotiations for the Trans-Pacific Trade Pact. Of course, what's I find interesting about the reaction to it, well, first of all, it'd be interesting to know who the leaker is. Obviously, it's somebody that felt the public and the Congress needed to know. And that's a fair assumption, right?
That could be an assumption.
Yeah. So, but isn't there something interesting about this, Laurie Wallach, in the sense that there is a kind of political coalition here that spans the left and the right that are concerned about this? There are the sort of Ron Paul conservative sovereignty fundamentalists, if you will, and progressive activists. I mean, this is something that I see as being fairly incendiary because it covers such a broad swath of political opinion.
You know, you would expect that to be the case, and the polling certainly shows that majorities of Republicans, independents, and Democrats oppose more agreements based on the NAFTA, the North American Free Trade Agreement model. And from what I've just seen of this text, TPP would be as if NAFTA and the most extended version of NAFTA, the Korea Free Trade Agreement, had a baby, and then they only fed it steroids for a year. That's what we're dealing with now. So you would assume that the conservatives would be up in arms, but the conservatives in Congress actually went along with a couple of these agreements that Bush had negotiated, Obama pushed through, that is not as extreme as this proposal, had some of these elements, such as limiting the use of Buy America procurement or submitting the U.S. to the jurisdiction of certain foreign tribunals to adjudicate cases. So it is a mystery, perhaps the base of the conservatives movement hadn't really caught on to that agreement, and maybe they will hear now about TPP, but it's a mystery how the Republicans in Congress voted, because when those agreements came up last October, the highest percentage of Democrats ever voting against the Democratic president's trade agreement said no, but the smallest percentage of Republicans ever opposed. The Pauls were two of them, but many other very conservative Republicans didn't seem to understand what really these agreements were, that they're not about free trade, but that they are about these tribunals and about basically undermining core principles of federalism, of checks and balances that do have a bipartisan appeal.
But in a word, what these agreements are about is corporatism.
Well, and that gets, you know, everything comes back to Citizens United, I'm afraid, which is to say everything comes back to money and politics. My suspicion of what happened is that the big companies that like these agreements, I mean, this agreement that leaked has all those same rules that were in NAFTA that promote offshoring, that make it much less risky, much easier to relocate U.S. plants, investment money, equipment to a developing country. Vietnam is in this agreement, so the low-cost alternative to China for offshoring. All of those big companies give a boatload of money to the conservatives, to the organizations, the conservative organizations. The Tea Party groups were notably silent on something they certainly could have attacked Obama on, secret tribunals at the World Bank and United Nations giving out U.S. Treasury dollars, sounds like something you would hear from right-wing radio, except they were really quiet. And I suspect it has to do with the money, as well as many very conservative members of Congress. Now, the base across the country, Democratic, Republican, conservative, progressive, independent, we are the ones who can make a difference with this, because just fundamentally, the lunatic proposals that were unearthed when this agreement leaked today are such that they really are uniting. It doesn't matter what part of the political spectrum you're on. You're not going to want some international rules setting in cement one set of law and one set of policy that cannot be changed, but for the agreement of eight other countries that determine things like how expensive our medicines will be, or whether or not we can have food safety inspection, or whether or not we or our local government or our state government can set land use rules, that's even in here, or whether or not we can use our tax dollars to procure goods and services from U.S. companies and replant our tax dollars in our communities to grow our economy. All of those non-trade issues get set, and the agreement requires countries shall conform their domestic laws, regulations, and administrative procedures with those rules. And if the country, either Congress or our state legislators, do not do so, we're subject to these international tribunals. Now, if you heard someone just say that and you didn't look at the text, you might think, I'm a conspiracy theorist or a little paranoid, which is why I invite everyone to look at the text, because this is really a real deal.
How do they get the text, Lori?
If you go to our website, which is tradewatch.org, you can click on a link that will take you to the text, but more importantly, perhaps, is a section-by-section guided tour. We have an analysis that lists each provision and what it means, translated out of the technical language, and then it links back to other sources so you can double-check our work.
So, Lori Wallach, this international tribunal, this is not new. This is already in place because in early June, a tribunal at the World Bank agreed to hear a case involving foreign investment standards, similar to what you're talking about here with this Trans-Pacific Partnership. The El Salvador banned cyanide-based gold mining, largely due to objections from the Catholic Church and environmental activists. And the World Bank is now about to rule, and it could rule against El Salvador and overturn the nation's domestic laws at the behest of a foreign corporation. I don't know if it's a mining corporation. I think it's Canadian, but that's beside the point. I mean, there's an example. What I find interesting about the leak that you've revealed today from these trade negotiations is that Australia has refused to submit to the jurisdictions of these investor state private corporation enforcement foreign tribunals.
But here's what's different in this proposal. Yes, you are right that CAFTA and NAFTA have a version of this, but this is the most grandiose version. This version would allow disputes over procurement contracts with governments and foreign investors to run utilities, even concessions for foreign investors and companies to have access to Western lands for mining or for grazing or for timber, all of that would now go to the tribunal. It's not just the old NAFTA stuff. It's much more expansive. It's shifting much more of our decision-making out of accountable open venues, and it is changing the balance between government and domestic companies versus foreign investors in a transformational way, even compared to the damage in that regard done by NAFTA. So yes, there has been some of this. This is a significant expansion of it. And meanwhile, Obama as a candidate explicitly promised, as you noted, that he would ensure trade agreements gave no greater rights to foreign investors, that our trade agreements wouldn't undermine U.S. regulatory and environmental policy. And this is the antithesis of it. Now, the only good news is we sometimes talk about the Dracula strategy. When something has been so secret and is so extreme, when it's dragged out into the sunshine, if the public gets involved and demands that this is unacceptable, these agreements in the past have been stopped. The last really big one was a regional one in Latin America, and because the public from the Arctic to the Antarctic, basically, it was all the Americas, got up in arms about these kind of crazy proposals, the agreement was stopped. But if we're quiet about it, if we don't continue to dig, if we don't demand the whole agreement's released, we could literally see this kind of imposition of corporate rule via so-called trade agreement through the Trans-Pacific Partnership.
And, of course, corporations have the ability or the advantage that they're both domestic and multinational, and that's why they, for example, don't pay a lot of taxes. They move their profits offshore to their offshore affiliates. So they're already wired, aren't they, to avoid sovereignty?
Well, this gets to your point about Australia. What's with Australia? Why are we signing ourselves up to these dreadful tribunals and Australia isn't? And your point about transnational companies is the fine point of that story. Australia has now been sued by Philip Morris, tobacco giant, who found one of its subsidiaries in Hong Kong, which had standing under a different agreement, to use the foreign tribunals to attack Australia's what's called plain packaging rule on tobacco. It's a very effective regime of basically trying to make tobacco sales less appealing, particularly to young people. And Australia has this law that applies to domestic brands, to imported brands. You just can't glitz it up on the tobacco. And Philip Morris has dragged Australia to one of these tribunals, claiming that their investor rights, their investment in building their copyright, their branding, their marketing, their packaging, has been taken away by this law. Now, no discrimination, reasonable science-based law being attacked. Australia basically had it. And there have been a variety of these kinds of threats increasingly against health laws, against environmental laws, against financial regulations, so that, for instance, India has announced it will renegotiate its existing agreements that have this private corporate enforcement, and it will not sign any future agreements with them. Brazil has refused to sign a single one of these kinds of agreements. Increasingly, countries are saying no. That makes it even more disgraceful that this leaked text shows the U.S. is the lead pusher of this regime. And this Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement could well be the last agreement we negotiate, so getting it right is really important. The reason I say that is they intend to have this agreement stay open for any new country to join. So last month, the trade representative, Ron Kirk, said nothing would make him happier than if China joined this agreement. So we really need to get the rules right. We do not want this tribunal system for the whole world. It would set up literally a two-track system of justice, where systematically, officially, formally, corporations are privileged over all the rest of us.
Again, I'm speaking with Laurie Wallach, who's the founder and director of Global Trade Watch, a division of the nonprofit watchdog group Public Citizen. And today, Public Citizen posted leaked documents from the Obama administration's free trade negotiations for the Trans-Pacific Partnership Trade Pact. And Ron Kirk, of course, is the U.S. Trade Representative. And this deal is strongly supported by the U.S. Chamber of Commerce and by Republican candidate Mitt Romney, who's urged the U.S. to finalize the deal as soon as possible. And, of course, the details that have been leaked that Laurie Wallach got hold of are clearly the Obama administration's position on this. What do you know about Ron Kirk and what this administration? I mean, how vulnerable are they? You would think that they would be vulnerable. First of all, a lot of people on the left of the Democratic Party, the progressives, are pretty disillusioned with the Obama administration, and this leak doesn't help in that. I noticed, for example, that the Secretary of Commerce, who's obviously, his portfolio is related to trade. He had an accident out here in California, and it turned out, he was driving a Lexus, for God's sake. Not exactly a good message for Buy America, you know.
Hey, yay, yay. I hadn't even thought about that angle directly, actually. The thing I think that I would say to people who are saying, what the heck is going on with the Obama administration? What happened to President Obama's commitments to get rid of these problems when he was a candidate? Is President Obama needs to get with his trade negotiators. They have not got the memo, which is to say, ultimately, the buck stops with President Obama. So there is an argument to be made that the trade negotiations, being very secretive and background, have not gotten the full attention of the White House. It's not inconceivable, given the White House is putting enormous amounts of effort and priority into doing several things that these negotiations would explicitly forbid, like expanding Buy America to try and build out our green economy, like trying to lower medicine prices using medicine formularies, which this agreement would subject to challenge by the big pharmaceutical companies, like the Obama administration has been pushing improved financial regulation, except the agreement would explicitly forbid, for instance, bans on risky products and services. A ban is considered a zero quota, which is forbidden, even if you are doing it to domestic and foreign firms. It's just simply forbidden. That's why I say when it's a corporate rule document, I'm not exaggerating. It really is the rules that you would write if you didn't have to actually consider the public and were just writing the rules of the corporation. So with all of these conflicts, I would say the president really needs to get with his trade negotiators and get in with the program. And to the extent he doesn't do so, then it's his responsibility. So we can all agree on a good kind of trade agreement, but this sure as heck isn't it. And if we all want to get involved in airing it out, we can make sure we have the option of not having this locked in as our future. TradeWatch.org, our website, has not only the leaked text and analysis, but, for instance, a very funny video animation where we have taken the Jackson 5 ABC song and made it TPP, and it's the corporate power tool, which we actually have an animated corporate power tool that gives you the picture of what this agreement's really about. It's very short. It's very funny. So get laughing, get angry, and then everyone can take action.
I thank you so much for joining us here today, Laurie Wallach.
Thank you very much.
Again, I've been speaking with Laurie Wallach, who's the founder and director of Global Trade Watch, a division of the nonprofit watchdog group Public Citizen. Wallach is an expert on the operations and outcomes of trade policies such as NAFTA, the WTO, and CAFTA. She works closely with Congress, scholars, and activists in the U.S. and developing countries to foster the growing debate about implications of different models of globalization on jobs, offshoring, wages, the environment, public health and food safety, equality and social justice, and democratically accountable governance. Today, Public Citizen posted leaked documents from the Obama administration's free trade negotiations for the Trans-Pacific Partnership Trade Pact. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back and go to Europe to get a sense of the increasing gloom in the Eurozone. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters. This is Background Briefing. And joining us now from Prague in the Czech Republic is James Galbraith, who is a professor at the Lyndon B. Johnson School of Public Policy at the University of Texas in Austin. He's also a senior scholar of the Levy Economics Institute and serves as chair of the Board of Economists for Peace and Security. His books include Balancing Act, Technology, Finance, and the American Future, Created Unequal, The Crisis in American Play, and The Predator State. And his latest book is Inequality and Instability. Welcome to Background Briefing, James Galbraith.
Nice to be with you.
And you're in. I learned a new word today, James, Eurogloom. Would you say that that's an appropriate word for the moment?
Well, there is a fair amount of it around, yes.
And what's your sense of whether, I mean, I've been discussing this for 2.5 years, asking the same question over and over again, when will the Europeans get their hands around this continuing debt problem? The longer they dither, the worse the situation gets. And it just seems to, the same question keeps arising.
Well, I think it's fair to say that the European leadership does not have a comprehensive plan and cannot really come up with one under the political constraints faced by the leaders, particularly in Germany. So we're looking at a situation in which the major action right now is in the hands of the ordinary people who are trying to protect themselves as best they can from what they fear will become an uncontrolled situation.
But that suggests, does it not, that people left to their own devices will create a run on the euro. The Greeks will cash their Greek euros in for German euros or English pounds, etc.
The Greek banking system has already lost a fair fraction of its deposits. And I was having a conversation at lunch today with a professional who follows these things from here, who says that they're driving to the nearest point in the eurozone where they can open accounts, and that's in southern Austria. There's a physical movement of cash, which has an interesting consequence. Then it means that if Greece does exit, that cash will be buffered. It will be the euro will, of course, survive, and those who have taken their money out would be in a very strong position to go back in with solid assets that would be worth a great deal more than they were when they moved them out. So it's a classic, and it's sort of a poor man's speculative move against the home currency. And you've got to expect that that is also happening at the level of high-powered investors.
And clearly happening in Spain, and I don't know whether they're driving to the French border or not, but the benchmark 10-year bond yield in Spain hit 6.81 in spite of a recent bailout of $150 billion.
The Spanish yields were not favorably influenced by the bailout action, that's clear. I don't know what the extent of losses and deposits in the Spanish banks is at the moment, but it would be fairly easy to find out.
And the Austrian finance minister, Maria Fechter, on Monday refused to rule out that Italy may need an EU rescue money in the coming months, prompting Italy's Prime Minister, Mario Monti, to call her remarks completely inappropriate. What do you know about what's happening in Italy? Is that another shoe that's going to drop?
Well, shoes can drop in this situation quite readily as investors decide that they have opportunities. So you have a situation in which it doesn't matter what the political situation is in the country or what the underlying economic situation is. You don't need bad news. You simply need a sense that that there's going to be a movement against a country's position. Then, of course, investors are going to move, speculators are going to move to take advantage of that.
So what is then, again, to that central question of who gets their hands around it? Who creates a firewall? I mean, there's some creation of some new European banking. There's the European Financial Stability Facility, and there's a new fund called the European Stability Mechanism. But nobody seems to think that at the end of the day, these are Band-Aids. And at the end of the day, it really comes down to Angela Merkel and whether or not she's can rise above being a politician and become a statesman and make some bold move. I imagine the White House has been begging her to do something for probably the last year. President Obama's fate in many ways is in her hands in terms of his re-election. What's your understanding of pressure on Merkel and whether she's likely to step up to the plate?
Well, I think Angela Merkel is a very capable German politician and that she is very unlikely to do anything that would jeopardize her future as Chancellor of Germany. And that means that she's not going to be terribly open to making any obvious move under, let's say, the pressure from the U.S. Treasury, which has its own concerns in the matter. Those are not... unless the U.S. has some way to turn them into a political concern for Chancellor Merkel, I don't see why that would be very high on her list.
Well, but the Germans have clearly been the beneficiaries of the euro, and they're being somewhat fair weather friends, aren't they? They're not basically the average German voter thinks that it's about the problem is because of a bunch of lazy Greeks and Italians and Spaniards who don't pay their taxes.
This is why Greece is being sacrificed, and this is in many ways this is a thoroughly reprehensible policy. You have the principle of collective responsibility being applied to a small country of 11 million people, a country whose institutions were never very strong to begin with, and they are being effectively destroyed in this process, under terms that are at best hypocritical. But I think even now the hypocrisy has gone out of it. This is purely a case of a punishment inflicted in order to cater to the political pressures in Germany. And that punishment consists of destroying the education system, destroying the hospital system, destroying the transport system, basically undoing the core institutions of Greece, which, of course, is not going to attract foreign investors. And that is why the Greek public has quite rightly come to the conclusion, a very large part of it has come to the conclusion, this is not a policy mix that they should accept. And we're likely to see, we don't know exactly how the Greek elections next Sunday are going to come out, but it's very likely that the Greek public will express itself on this subject.
Again, I'm speaking with James Galbraith, who is a professor at the Lyndon B. Johnson School of Public Policy at the University of Texas in Austin. He's also a senior scholar of the Levy Economics Institute and serves as chair of the Board of Economists for Peace and Security. And his latest book is Inequality and Instability. The Greek people are being punished and the Spanish people are being punished. Young Spaniards, the 50% unemployed, over 50% of them are unemployed. The question seems to be, though, here that if they're indeed these borrowers are irresponsible, in the case of Spain, I understand a lot of it was a housing bubble created by demand from Germans who wanted to buy extra homes in summer homes in Spain. But the long and the short of it is the lenders, irresponsible or not, are being the borrowers, irresponsible or not, are being punished, and the lenders, largely in the case of Spain, and I think also in the case of Greece, are German banks. They're not being punished. Is that what's going on?
Well, the populations of the borrowing countries are being punished. They are not necessarily borrowers in any personal sense. And you've got to remember, too, that while everybody says Greece was the one case of a public sector fiscal crisis, that crisis was, some part of it was the funding of, let's say, the construction projects associated with the Olympics, the construction project associated with the Athens Metro. This was not done by Greek engineering firms. The contracts and so forth, a great part of them came from Northern Europe. And there's also the fact that Greece has a very substantial military budget, which has a large procurement element, which includes battle tanks and submarines that come from, guess where, Germany. So it's not the case that even the debts of the Greek state are entirely due to, let's say, profligate consumption expenditures by ordinary Greek citizens. It's, in fact, very far from the case.
So at the end of the day, though, James Galbraith, it seems that what's going on here is that these countries in trouble in Europe, they're borrowing more money, but they're not doing anything about growth. And that is that the central problem here, that we've had austerity?
Growth is kind of a very easy thing to call for, but the word covers a great many sins and a great many policy prescriptions, many of which are purely chimerical. That is to say, to be for growth is in political terms to be for whatever it was you were for anyway. And there is no easy formula by which you can return the Eurozone as a whole to growth under current conditions. So you have to deal with the fact that you have a banking crisis that is. Your immediate threat is that the payment system is going to come unglued. Simon Johnson, the former IMF chief economist, had a very interesting piece a few days ago as you said, that one of the ways this is going to unravel is, in addition to the capital flight issue, that private citizens will simply cease making payments in euro in anticipation of their debts being converted back to another currency. And so this will start happening perhaps in Greece or Spain. I think Germany wants to prevent the exit from the eurozone of any such country. It probably can do so, and it's certainly very much in Germany's interest to do so. So long as there isn't really decisive change in policy, you do have the fact that private economic actors have ways to protect themselves and to reduce their exposure, and they will be increasingly taking those ways. And ultimately, if there are no jobs available, it's not going to be solved by growth, but it's going to be solved by people leaving those countries to the extent they can. Greece is a small place. The professional class of Greece is quite small. It has a large diaspora in the United States and Australia, and you can bet that people are making plans to move if they have the capacity.
But James Galbraith, at this point, it seems that what's happening is that the banks are being bailed out, but not the economies, and that there's been this pattern that I've alluded to and I've been discussing for the last couple of years here, that it all comes down to doing too little too late. Do you, again, going back to the question about the bold move, is there going to be one?
No, I don't think there will be. I think in the nature of it, the requirement on Chancellor Merkel's government is that they do that which is necessary to preserve the eurozone as a whole and that which is necessary to preserve the German banks. And they have the power to do that, certainly, but the price of the machinations required to achieve that is that they, as I say, in a very cynical and rather brutal way, dismantle a member of the European community, in particular Greece, and impose stagnation and increasingly socially intolerable conditions on some of the others, notably Spain, also Ireland for that matter, but that's also a very small country. The countries which are in a position to object forcefully and effectively to this line of policy have not yet done so. And they are, first of all, Italy, and secondly, France. France is in an ambivalent position, but it does have a new president and a new political mood. Italy is a country which, as you noted, is open to speculative attack and may ultimately start to develop a Mediterranean politics that begins to argue forcefully for a change in the European picture. And Italy is large enough to make that case in the councils of Europe in some way that really can't be ignored.
Well, the George Soros recently said that what we're witnessing in the eurozone is an emergence of a new German empire. I guess an allusion to what Germany failed to do militarily in the early 1940s, they managed to do economically in 2012.
Well, it might as well be Charlemagne, you know.
Mm-hmm. So, what's your response to that notion?
In the nature of this, I don't think Germany will have the last word. Ultimately, I mean, even if the governments of the peripheral regions do not and cannot effectively oppose the German policy, their populations will increasingly do so. And that's where the final word on this issue is going to come from.
But the German population has not been educated to the real issues. They've again, it's been racialized between the North-South divide.
It's a very important point. I mean, it's a very effective way of making this case. This is a question which has increasingly been racialized in a very primitive and deplorable way.
And who's going to step up to the plate and stop this and, you know, be the adult?
Ultimately, if it's going to be stopped, the responsibility to do so will be upon those populations who are being victimized. And they, ultimately, that's, I think, what will have to happen. I don't see that their governments are going to step up for them in advance of their populations putting their feet down and saying no. And you can see some of this developing in Spain. You can certainly see the waves of protests in Greece. And these are not unreasonable protests. People understand that the underlying purposes of the European Union as they understood it are being, totally contravened. Policy is abetting a movement in the opposite direction, a movement that allows one part of the union to be enriched while another part becomes, the previously poorer part, becomes even more deeply impoverished. And that is, not something people are going to buy into indefinitely.
Well, just in closing, James Galbraith, the European Commission has recommended a European banking union to oversee all the banking in all 27 EU states. President Obama recently, and I guess it was a way of throwing a bone to Angela Merkel, said it's bad enough for me having to deal with one Congress, but having to deal with 17 has got to be a bit of a nightmare. What are the hopes of this European banking union coming into being? Because obviously they don't have a Federal Reserve like we do. And, you know, the kind of money that's gone out to stabilize the euro is nothing compared to what happened after the crash of 2008 here.
Well, let's talk about that. A banking union would entail a common insurance scheme, and a common insurance scheme must entail a regulatory authority that's capable of closing down banks that are insolvent, which it would quickly be discovered many of them are. That would entail a very major shift of authority, essentially a new unity to the Eurozone and a breaking apart of what have been very tight political relationships between national banking systems and national governments. So that is an interesting proposition, but it is one with very profound, structural implications for the governance of the Eurozone. Should it happen, it would be truly a sign that things are changing very rapidly over here. But it's an enormous mountain. It's not something you can just decree and have come into existence from one day to the next. The whole mechanism of how the thing would run would have to be determined, and then you really have to test of whether the banks that have that are in danger of failing would be shut down by regulators who would not necessarily come from those countries.
Well, I started out by asking about this new word, Euro gloom, and I've ended up feeling somewhat gloomy, James Galbraith. But
sorry, I haven't been able to help you on that.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here from Europe.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with James Galbraith, who is a professor at the Lyndon B. Johnson School of Public Policy at the University of Texas in Austin. He's also a senior scholar of the Levy Economics Institute and serves as the chair of the Board of Economists for Peace and Security. His books include Balancing Acts, Technology, Finance, and the American Future, Created Unequal, The Crisis in American Pay, and The Predator State. His latest book is Inequality and Instability. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back talking about the Latino vote, the sleeping giant that could determine the 2012 election.
And keep on wishing. Remember your dream is your only scheme. So keep on pushing.
This election could well be decided by Latino voters.
I'm gonna vote for Obama. I'm gonna vote for Obama. Me and my mama gonna vote for Obama. Voy a votar por Obama. Voy a votar por Obama.
Senator Obama understands the Latino community.
Obama is our candidate.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters. This is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Angela Kelly, who is Vice President for Immigration Policy and Advocacy at the Center for American Progress, a well-known authority on the policy and politics of immigration. She has published numerous impactful reports on the economic value of immigration reform, the costs of mass deportation, and integration trends of America's newcomers. Previously, Kelly served as Director of the Immigration Policy Center, and prior to that was Deputy Director of the National Immigration Forum. She's the head of the team that released the infographic report from the Center for American Progress that indicates the Latino vote is a political sleeping giant that, if awakened, could determine the outcome of this year's election. Welcome to Background Briefing, Angela Kelly.
Thank you. So nice to talk with you.
So, as the lead on this infographic report that's been released today that indicates the Latino vote is the sleeping giant, what I find extraordinary about your findings is that there's an estimated 21.5 million Latino voters who are eligible to vote, and there's an additional 8.1 million green card holders that if they were naturalized, they could register, and some could do so before October. Is that right?
That's right. October is the day, it varies by state, but it's the month that most people have to register by in order to vote in the election that'll be the next month. You know, so here we are in the middle of June, and a lot of lawful permanent residents, of course, already have their naturalization papers being processed. And as long as that process is complete and they're sworn in as citizens, they can go that same day and register to vote. And if all that happens by October, then they'll be in the voting booth, we hope, in November.
So what explains, then, this enormous number of green card holders, 8.1 million, and you've got 21.5 million eligible Latino voters and more than a third that could be eligible? What explains this lag in why people don't become citizens?
Well, there are a lot of people who are becoming citizens. On average, over the last 9 years, there's been about 750,000 people a year who are naturalizing. So that's not an insignificant number. Sometimes it's as much as a million. But why others who are eligible don't do it right away? I mean, first of all, it's a difficult process. It's expensive. It costs nearly $800 to naturalize. You also have to show that you have a mastery of American civics and history and that you can speak English. And you have to deal with a government agency, the Department of Homeland Security, which many people find intimidating and frustrating. So I think those are some of the reasons. And I also think, frankly, just human nature. People are comfortable as legal permanent residents. They're part of our society. They're working, they're busy, and it may be something that there's not like a notice that you get in the mail that says, come on, naturalize, naturalize, naturalize. And so it's something that you have to really do of your own initiative.
Well, clearly there's been a lot of reports that both the Republicans and the Democrats are very interested in harvesting this vote, if you will. I'm fascinated that there aren't any actual statistics that you've told us, Angela Kelly, on the difference between the number of eligible Latino voters who are citizens and those that have registered. I would have thought that there'd be some statistics on that, but apparently they're not. So what we don't quite know how big this pool is. It's been described as the sleeping giant, and this is going to be a very close election by all predictions. So unquestionably, it will be a question of who gets to these potential voters. And I take it the assumption's always been that the Democrats have taken them for granted, and on the other hand, the Republicans have alienated a lot of these voters. So tell us, well, let's begin with this. What is Mitt Romney doing to get this vote?
Well, Mitt Romney talked a lot about the issue of immigration early on in the primaries. He staked out a very tough position. He moved further and further to the right the more he talked about it. He talked about his support for state immigration laws like the very punitive Show Me Your Papers laws in Arizona. He described how he thought people should self-deport, and if we just have tougher and tougher enforcement policies, that people will just leave on their own, something that was immediately scoffed at by immigrants themselves and those who follow this issue closely. He would want to have a mandatory electronic verification system that all employers would have to follow and that all workers, U.S. citizens, U.S.-born immigrants, all would have to be able to clear a government database in order to be able to work. So he put out a number of tough policies, and there's a piece of legislation called the DREAM Act that would give undocumented immigrant youth who've been here for a long time and are here without papers through no fault of their own status. And Mitt Romney said that he would veto the DREAM Act. That's something that is it's a bill that comes with a lot of support in the Latino community. It polls at 90%. Even the non-Latino community is a popular piece of legislation because it's really aimed at young people, and he would veto it. He said that if Justice Sotomayor were a confirmation that he could have a vote for or against her, he would have voted against her. And, of course, she's the first Hispanic female Supreme Court justice. Again, very popular in the Latino community. So he has dug himself in a very deep hole with this community around this issue and his embrace of very tough enforcement policies, and hasn't really, frankly, been very respectful to the community in acknowledging a broken immigration system, the contributions that people make to this country, or even being willing to consider doing something for undocumented youth.
A part of this report indicates that California's nearly 4.5 million potential Latino voters surpassed by four times the 1 million voters that were the margin of victory in the 2008 presidential election. So I get your metaphor here of the sleeping giant. And you've just told us a lot of reasons why Latinos are not particularly thrilled with Mitt Romney. What about Obama that is likely to attract them?
Well, Obama is also, I think, under close scrutiny by the Latino and immigrant community on the issue of immigration. Obama had indicated that he wanted very much to have comprehensive immigration legislation passed in his first year. It was a promise that he made. It was highly visible. It was repeated over and over. And, of course, it didn't happen. The president has also been, while he's been in office, there will have been more people deported in the first 4 years than there were under 8 years of President Bush. So he has overseen a very vigorous enforcement policies that have been expanding the state level through something called secure communities. And those are all things that are causing, frankly, people to pause. They have a high degree of concern about that. At the same time, he has wanted to pass legislation. He did get behind the DREAM Act, has been very supportive of it, and it has been largely members of the other political party that haven't been at all supportive and have made it difficult, like with all issues, to get anything done in Washington. So he bears some of the blame, but certainly not all of the blame, not even the majority of the blame, given that it was, you know, his party wasn't the problem. It really very much was the Republicans. So we'll see. I think it's a question mark. I don't think that the Latino community is going to turn out and vote necessarily for Mitt Romney. I do think, though, there's a question about whether people will just sit out the election if they just feel that neither candidate is speaking to issues of concern that are, you know, unique to their community. And they may just sit this one out. And that's something that certainly the Obama administration would be concerned about.
But just in closing, though, Angela Kelly, if that in eight states the number of potential Latino voters is greater than the margin of victory in the 2000 presidential election, and we've already talked about the enormous numbers here of the 8.1 million green card holders that could be eligible if they got naturalized and registered before October. This is a considerable voting pool. One would think that just on the merits alone of being citizens, being able to be involved in this country, that would be sufficient. Whether it's the partisan issues notwithstanding, I mean, this is a massive constituency that could be politically active. So.
It is, and we've seen an increase in their activity over the years. You do have more and more Latino voters turning out in each election cycle. And as I said, you know, we have on average 750,000 people naturalizing every year. So there is definitely an uptick, and a steady one at that, in folks becoming interested in the political process and in wanting to vote. And you saw that even in the 2010 election, where more Latinos turned out for that midterm election than they had in any previous one. And they were a decisive factor in some key Senate races, including in Nevada, Harry Reid, who was very much down in the polls. Everybody thought that his opponent, Sharon Angle, had it all locked up. Latino voters turned out in extraordinary record-breaking percentages. I think it was in the high 80s, and he kept his seat. Same in Colorado with Mike Bennett. Mike Bennett has attributed his victory in part to the Latino community coming out and voting for him, again at a very high rate. I think 85% of Latinos who voted for Mike Bennett in the Colorado race in 2010. So they can be tapped to act, and I think that they will continue to be. And we've got a long, hot summer ahead of us. The Supreme Court decision on the Arizona immigration law will come out at the end of this month. How the president responds to that, how candidate Romney responds to that, is, I promise you, going to be the top story in Spanish-language press for days and days and days. So there is a lot that is going to be poking at these this giant, and I think we'll get them to turn out to vote.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Angela Kelly.
Okay, thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Angela Kelly, who's the Vice President for Immigration Policy and Advocacy at the Center for American Progress, a well-known authority on the policy and politics of immigration. She has published numerous impactful reports on the economic value of immigration reform, the cost of mass deportation, and the integration trends of American newcomers. Previously, she served as Director of the Immigration Policy Center, and prior to that was the Deputy Director of the National Immigration Forum. She headed up the team that produced this new infographic report released by the Center for American Progress. It indicates the Latino voter is a political sleeping giant that, if awakened, could determine the outcome of this year's election. And this has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Chris Scheid. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.